dice are loaded, everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost.
Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, Friday, June 19th, as we're almost into summer. We're standing on the threshold of summer. Where I am here in Colorado, it's very warm today. Don't know where it's what it's like where you are, but we're all experiencing various iterations of climate change. One can no longer predict the weather as we've been able to do in the past, and we're going to talk about that today. I've got a couple of guests with me with whom I hope to have a very enlivening conversation, and we're also going to hear later in the show from a man from California who is running for the California Senate on one issue, not gun violence, not ISIL, not the economy, but simply climate change. We'll be talking with him later in the show. I was absolutely floored by what I have read so far from Pope Francis' encyclical regarding climate change. And I want to begin the show with just one quote from it. It's actually just one sentence. Now, please understand that I'm not a big fan of the Catholic Church. I'm not a big fan of Pope Francis by any stretch. But I have great respect for this person who's got quite a bit of power coming forth and penning this encyclical. And here's the quote that I want to lead into our conversation with today. He said, "Our goal is not to amass information or to satisfy curiosity, but rather to become painfully aware, to dare to turn what is happening to the world into our own personal suffering, and thus to discover what each of us can do about it." Dare to turn what is happening to the world into our own personal suffering. And so my guest today and I are going to talk about that. First, I have my friend Peter Melton from Northern California. Are you there, Peter?
I am here.
All right. Well, I'm very glad that you're here. So glad to have you on the show today, and wondering what you think and feel about the Pope's message to us.
Yeah, well, thank you again for the great work you do and having this show where folks can dig into their feelings and thoughts and hearts about these key topics. And hello, listeners out there in listener land. Wow, just a big day all around where somebody with some power is daring to speak directly to this major topic that has otherwise been largely brushed under the rug, and to speak directly to the issues of stewardship of the planet and moral obligation and population, and man, it's a game changer.
It absolutely is. And you know, one of the things that just really stood out for me, it reminded me of what Naomi Klein has written in her book and talked about. It's as if he's telling us that we have a moral obligation to bring down industrial civilization. What was your take?
Well, you know, I got to admit, I've only read a little bit of it and watched a couple of video clips, but I got the feeling that first flushed over me. I was raised Catholic, so you know, he's held in kind of a different vibe maybe for me than for others, but I was raised that way. And so to hear him be bold and daring and against the system, if you will, or presenting opposing views, I'm personally still dealing with that old feeling that you're not supposed to buck the system, that it is what it is. Don't ask questions. These kinds of things that were left over from my upbringing, that just to read what I have read and to listen to what I have listened to is like, oh my God, here's the head guy saying, wait a minute, everybody, we've got to change the way we've been doing this, is still just a wow shocker to me.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And, you know, you and I have talked about before, and certainly Guy McPherson has talked about, that really the only way to slow things down in terms of catastrophic climate change is to bring industrial civilization to a halt. But then that has its own problems in terms of the consequences of that, in terms of nuclear power and those kinds of things. So it's really a rock and a hard place between which humanity finds itself at the moment.
Yeah, and the instant inclination for me to try to think about it all, whereby what we've been working on here with the work we've been doing with you and your work with workshops and whatnot, and is to begin to feel this and to hear the Pope talk about that, like you said in the opening sentence, that we need to become painfully aware and to really feel the pain of our brothers and sisters, to own that there's a human family to start with, and then to own that there's the whole family of all sentient beings, is just such a diversion from the way our power and consumerism minds have been programmed. And so it's really quite a shock, and I'm really looking forward to talking to Dean Walker, who's our first guest, and maybe we can just bring him on, because I know he's had a chance to look more deeply at this and feel into it as well. Dean, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me okay over there?
You sound terrific from Southern
Dean
Oregon.
Walker from Oregon, and Dean has been involved with Essence and Image Media Production, which does coaching and training and probably lots of other things. Dean, welcome to the Lifeboat Hour again. You've been on the show before. We'd like to hear what you have to say in terms of this encyclical.
Well, I am completely with the both of you that this is a monumental day. I am also not a Catholic. I was I grew up in and around the Catholic religion, but it was not something that I had to do in my part of the family. And I find myself just stopping dead in my tracks today and realizing the immensity of the pulpit that the Pope has, not only with Catholics, but with people around the world who may or may not be connected with that religion. The ferocity of his message, the clarity and depth of his message, and the completely unapologetic nature of his message is very inspiring to me. So I am floored, deeply pleased, and it's rare that I get really any positive messages to consider in any given day, given how frequently we are all getting the many, many messages of how badly things are going. And so I'm savoring this moment and just hoping against hope that this has some sort of significant positive impact for us globally.
Well, you know, I want to go back to that quote for just a second. And again, I want to emphasize, Peter mentioned it as well, you know, what Francis said, to dare to turn what is happening to the world into our own personal suffering, to dare to turn what is happening to the world into our own personal suffering. And what that implies for me is that we need to grieve what's going on. Not only grieve, there are other things we should be doing. We should be, you know, doing all of the things that we know that will make a happier environment, and having kindness and courtesy to other species, and making extinction or their suffering easier for them. But you were with me last weekend, Dean, at a grief weekend workshop that I did in Rhode Island, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about your experience with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's hard to imagine, Carolyn, a more perfect quote for you to be able to extract from the encyclical
right.
than that. It just doesn't get any better than that.
Right.
However you suggested to the Pope to put that perfect mention in for you, I'd like to find out who your agent is. the workshop that I did with you, Carolyn, is indeed, from my perspective, essential work. And it's probably the hardest work to explain to the average person, much less enroll that person into that experience, I can't imagine a more difficult thing to describe and then to invite into. And the only exceptions I've found to that are people like you and obviously the other folks that were with us in Rhode Island, and myself, people who have some experience of grief, of what it is to be a fully feeling, sharing those feelings, sharing that depth with others. And there is nothing like it. Just flat out, I can't imagine a more potent single tool. It would be my desert island tool if I and a few others were on that imaginary desert island, which maybe we are. It's the one most powerful tool to have us experience the fullness of our humanity, the depth of our humanity, and to do that together. So that was my experiences of your workshop, was that here was a temporary village that we created with the others in the workshop, and all of us had this opportunity to be safe, to be cared for, and to be invited to share our tears, and ironically, of course, share our joy, share the fullness of our expression. And that's what this work is. It's not just about grief. It's just that grief is such a universal experience, and it is such a potent and easy to access door once you let yourself. But it obviously always shows up as the full range of expression gets to expand. As you covered that with Francis Weller in your recent webinar, it's the extra added benefit of sharing tears with others. Sharing grief with others means we get to share more of all the emotions, all of our humanity.
Well, thank you for that description, Dean, because in a very general way, that really outlines what the weekend workshop is about. And I am looking forward to doing more of these. It looks like I'll be doing one in Sebastopol, California, at the end of October, and another one at the Roe Conference Center at the end of November. Roe is in Massachusetts, so both ends of the country. Basically, it is a coming together to just share the grief that is on our hearts that could be personal. It could have to do with the loss of, people in our lives, or a pet, or, something else that we're grieving the loss of. Definitely, it involves grieving the loss of our planet. And, what we discover is that all of those griefs are connected. It's not one or the other. And they sort of take us into this big well of grief, as we call it, where we get to be together and hold each other emotionally and support each other and share our tears, as you said. And then, subsequent to that, share our joy, sometimes with fun and play and celebration. And certainly by the end of the workshop, a real sense of deep community. So all of that can happen in the space of 3 days, and I'm so glad you could be with us, Dean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel there's so much that grief has been misunderstood, that we can really sense that grief is a tool to get us into the feelings, and then those feelings and that communal space is a place that we find this passion to be more alive and to live our lives more fully. And Dean, I know this is what you're working on in other aspects of your life. Could you tell us a little bit about the work you're doing with elders coming up? And also tell us a little bit about this book you're writing.
Oh, thanks very much. It's been this remarkable synergy has been showing up for me. And one of the greatest pieces of that synergy has been to be connected with Peter and with Carolyn. And one of the main points points where we share our attention for the moment is this upcoming symposium that Carolyn, I think you've mentioned a couple times on the show. Somewhere in the fall of 2015, we are going to be offering a series of interviews that each of us will have done with really a cast of very familiar characters, I imagine, given how long you've been doing the show and what has been the emphasis of the show about collapse and also about, you know, abrupt climate change and so on. But I think what we share more than almost anything right now, Peter, Carolyn, myself, and I'm sure many of the listeners, is that it seems like the time for more and more and more stacks of information about abrupt climate change and collapse is really too much. You know, there's a saturation point that I think we all get to. And the book that I've got coming out, hopefully in the early fall coming up, and workshops that I'm designing as well, in addition to some webinar, you know, somehow or another, finding a way to express these very difficult topics in an intimate way in a webinar style is one of the biggest challenges I've ever faced. But we all seem to be leaning on that people want to connect with one another, and it seems like the reconnection is with ourselves, our own inner landscapes as we face these challenges, and of course with others, and, you know, other people, finding our tribe, finding our people, whether it's directly next door neighbor kind of connection or if it's somehow on the internet, whatever way we can connect with one another. And then obviously we need to the earth. And so that is, I know what you just got through saying, Carolyn, one of the main points of the workshops that you do, and from a slightly different angle, that's exactly the kind of connection that I'm pointing to and wanting to spark up in all the different types of work that I'm doing. So with self, others, and the earth. And that seems to be the desire right now. It seems to be the hunger and the calling.
Well, it is a very passionate hunger. Wherever I go, people say, you know, I'm glad I have the information. I've been reading about this for years or maybe just a few months. great information. It's not like I want to stop learning the facts, but what I'm really hungering for is connection with other people, community, and some tools for navigating this very daunting future, what little there is of it, with, you know, with heart, with compassion, with service, and, you know, using those tools to prepare myself and others around me who are open to listening for what we're going to go through and what we're already starting to go through. So, yeah, the hunger is huge.
Yeah. Carolyn, I know that for years now you've been offering people the service of life coaching, and I also have that same role in addition to the designing of courses and all that stuff.
You do.
And the calling, as it seems to show up in coaching, in the coaching environment, it's always seems to involve, how can I possibly broach this conversation with others? Mm-hmm. And you've covered that so beautifully in the book, and it's extraordinary the way you've pioneered these conversations. And I think the jargon I would put on it right now, and really it blends right back into the Pope conversation, is that we are all, I think, called to have what I call the impossible conversation. One way or another, whether it's with a relative or an intimate other or people at work or neighbors in our community, the extraordinary discomfort that can accompany those conversations, because people really just don't, flat out don't want to hear it. And I can certainly own my part of that. There are times when I just get to my saturation point with that.
Right.
But I am so refueled by the Pope's encyclical in a way that he is inviting billion Catholics on the planet to engage deeply in this that I'm calling the impossible conversation. So for his courage to stand like no other religious leader that I've seen and boldly invite, and in the case of the Catholics, I suppose he's ordering in some way, to stand up and have these impossible conversations and engage in an entirely new way.
Well, that's what I see as well. And, you know, it's not like it's not like other religious leaders haven't dealt with the topic of climate change, but he's really crossed the line here where he's saying, we have got to ditch industrial civilization, ditch our way of life. And he makes that a moral obligation. I haven't seen any other religious leaders go to that extent. Now, I've seen people in the Catholic Church, radical folks, you know, some radical nuns I know, say that sort of thing, but not the Pope himself.
Yeah. And that, you know, it's funny. You and I have talked quite a bit about writing books, and I'm in my first book right now. And it's
I want to hear about it.
I've got my second one coming up, and we're kind of bumping on that one, up on that one. And mostly why I call this the impossible conversation is not so much even on the personal level as it is that we are in the industrial world. We are consumers before we're anything else.
Yes.
And so then to, you know, writing on what you just said, to try and dismantle that entire structure of who we see ourselves. We see ourselves as consumers before anything else. Mm. And to have that be at the core of how we're destroying our habit future is, well, the irony and the pain of that is, you know, it's very present for me right at this moment. And I can't think of a more daunting challenge for us to be taking on as a race.
Yes. Well, do tell us about your books, please.
Oh, well, yeah, I don't mean to make that a lead into that. I was just
no, that's
really
okay.
I
want to hear.
Okay,
I'm sure others want to hear too. And one of the books you've shared the topic with me, and I'll let you talk about it. But it sounds really juicy.
Yeah. Well, it's really sparked by the experience that I had, particularly last year, reconnecting with Peter and at that time Guy McPherson and a number of other folks, and having my jumping into the deep end of the conversation of the abrupt conversation of abrupt climate change. And it really rattled me. It rattled me because I was pretty well informed prior to that. But I was informed in the way that the usual media presents this information, which is some vague climate change effects will happen, and it will they will all happen somewhere about at the turn of the century, around 2100. Mm-hmm. And I had gotten a bit more urgent because I had heard of possibly some things showing up in the 2150 range. And still it was vague, but I was still very concerned. Then again, jumping off the deep end into the possibility that things could be happening far sooner than that, and quite a bit more specifically, like the downgrade of our habitat, like the plants that we count on us not being able to keep up with, to adapt, to evolve, to handle even 2 or 3 more degrees centigrade of temperature rise. That absolutely rattled me to the point of I've literally changed my orientation in life. I've made this my gift of service to the world is to write what I need to write, produce the video that I need to produce, to be engaged in the kind of creation of powerful live training. And what I am inviting people to do in the book that I will be bringing out and I'm targeting for end of August is how do we inform ourselves about whatever's important to us? And then how do we take that kind of inquiry into the world and start to do a personal inner inquiry. So in other words, where do I stand now that I have this rather dire information? What's important to me? How can I reorganize my priorities? How can I live my boldest, most positive life in the face of those dire circumstances? and just a privilege to be able to write that book. And Carolyn, I've really appreciated your input over these months as I'm doing the writing. I find it to be an extraordinary time, and it's really a pleasure to be counting you and Peter both, and as a number of your listeners, I'm sure, I consider y'all my tribe, and I think we all need to find our tribe in these times.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to say, Dean, that I'm really wanting to support writers like yourself. There are many, many wise people right now who are writing some incredible things about the global crisis and where we are in human history. And, you know, some of them trying to get published and they want me to look at their work, and I'm happy to do that when I have time. Sometimes I don't have time, but you know, my heart is really with people who want to express, you know, and create this kind of informed inquiry that you're talking about. And that's what we are planning to do with this symposium. I think I may have mentioned before on the show that this will be not so much a symposium of talking heads, but more a symposium of talking hearts, as we kind of get up close and personal with these people we're going to interview and ask them, how did you come to where you are? How do you feel about it? How has it impacted your life? What are you doing in your life in response? So I think it's going to be a unique and really exciting online event.
Yeah. I can't wait. I think this is one of the most exciting projects I've been able to be involved with. And to give the listeners just a little fragment of what I think we're pointing at here is one of the pieces of information that I got last fall was that we're currently losing 150 to 200 species a day on the planet. And a substantial amount of that is caused by human endeavor. And just to call it on myself, when I first heard that information, I kind of took it in like this part of the giant morass of information that I take in every day, and it became something like, well, okay, 150 to 200 species. Okay, fine. What's the next piece of information? And off I would go in my usual way. And what I can tell you is that my process has included slowing down.
Yes.
Like I slowed down to hear Pope Francis's encyclical today, and I will dive deeper and deeper into that as the days go on. When I just stopped for a moment last fall, and I really started to let this inquiry in, like let it move me, I'm changed by that. Mm-hmm. I'm changed by the fact that what we are doing collectively and my part in that, we are losing 150 to 200 species a day. And as each month goes by, we are clearly going in the wrong direction if we're committed to sustaining life on the planet, our own and others. So I'm moved, as I'm slowing down the way I'm speaking right now, I'm intentionally shifting my own state to feel. And I can feel more now, having slowed myself down, in just sharing that one piece. It's no longer normalized in my system that it's just another piece of information amongst the millions, and let's move on. And so what I would hope for in the symposium, and certainly in the book that I was describing and so on, is if we can allow ourselves to slow down or to shift our state volitionally, to be able to feel more fully, we will be far more fully human in the process. And then if we can do that and share that experience with others, I don't know how better to approach these daunting circumstances than to be able to find an optimal, a more receptive and expressive state in ourselves and then share that with others. So I just meant that as an example and a sharing.
Yeah, thank you. That's so well said, Dean. And I felt myself slowing down right there, too, is that in this fast-paced way of being,
that we have been marinated in and thrilled in to some degree. It's like this ability to slow it on down is one of these key elements, and that we can land in this slowed down place to say, wow, okay, let's really take a look at what's going on here so that we can accurately feel into this, so that then we can begin to have conversation and plant ideas and move ourselves in whatever ways we're feeling moved. So thank you for that, what I think really key piece.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to say, Dean, that you just brought up something for me that I think is monumentally important. I mean, almost I can't think of anything more important, is to emphasize, you said something about all of these things changed you and have caused you to become more human. And I don't know of anything that is more important in terms of a vision and a goal of my work around emotional and spiritual preparation than becoming more human. You know, my goal is not enlightenment. My goal is not walking on water. My goal is not physical survival of all this stuff. It's how do I become more human? And I hasten to add that as humans, we are much more than just species destroyers. We are much more than just consumers. There's a whole part of us that we need to really treasure, because sometimes we get so angry at our own species and so hurt by what our species has done to this planet that we sort of write ourselves off as, you know, well, get rid of humans, you know, the planet would just love it if we were gone, you know, we're just crap. And I don't subscribe to that. You know, part of what we have done is crap, but we are much more than our behavior on this planet. And so becoming more human is like becoming more elephant or becoming more rhinoceros, you know, becoming who we are, who we were meant to be. That's really what this is about.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that, Carolyn. And I'm moved to say and really just acknowledge for the amount of this conversation that you've literally crafted from the ground up. There, as far as I know, there's no other author on the planet that has done as much mapping of this very important territory as you have. So I thank you for your work.
Well, I thank you and Peter for valuing my work and for the ways in which you've been supporting me in recent months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've been daring to talk about what is this and how can we be support for people and how can we be support for ourselves and how can we slow down but at the same time try to be on the cutting edge of what's happening. You know, the information is already overwhelming if you look at it, and it's just going to become more and more. So here we sit, and I remember this amazing quote about, you know, humans thinking that we're a good species going somewhere important. And it really stuck in my head. That was from a Guy McPherson presentation, and I don't remember the guy who said it, but just saying that really landed. It's like, wait a minute, what is our species even all about? Are we a good species? Never mm-hmm. even stopped to slow down enough to wonder what does it mean to be human? How do I define that for myself, since we're not defining it culturally at all? And that's our homework assignment here that's due in 45 minutes, right? It's like you have to somehow contextualize all of human experience and then broaden it to all of life and then broaden it to all of the history of the illusion of time and come up with some beautiful way of saying it and guiding people into this process. And wow.
Well, the homework assignment is due by the end of our lives, and that may not be a really long time. So let's get on this work.
Mm. Yeah. And so I want my quest here. We have about five more minutes, I think, with you, Dean. before we bring on Mike Batix, who is daring to take himself into the political field with this as well. But, you know, we talk about the impossible conversation. Can we spend 5 minutes right now just pretending, not pretending, just let's have the impossible conversation, right? Hi, Dean. Mm-hmm. I hear you've got some powerful information you want to share with me. I'm open. Tell me what it is you want to tell me. What is this impossible conversation I've heard about?
Yeah, well, we are in it. You know, we've been doing it since we started talking in this particular show and
well,
virtually every other.
Tell me more specifically. I really only have 10 minutes right now, Dean. I'm having a cup of coffee, and then I got to go back to work. So what is this impossible conversation?
Okay. Well, I think if the invitation is also to kind of wrap it up for my participation,
right?
I would just take the gist of what I heard you say, Carolyn, of that more humanness. And I would just say that reconnection with Earth, reconnection with the entire system that is this habitat, this Earth, there's a huge scale. If one can just touch that for a moment, can expand our experience of self, not only to the edge of our skin, but then to include others, and then to include the animals, and then the earth itself, and beyond, for those who are really good at it. This is an extraordinary shift, and certainly, much to my amazement, that's what we saw and heard from the Pope in the encyclical, is this is a global presence issue. This is not a human being self-important. This is an issue of expanding ourselves to include all that we are and all that the earth is. And I can imagine no more inspiring and no larger scale a calling to be responding to. And that is the nature of the impossible conversation, because the other end of it, where we spend most, well, I'll speak for myself, where I spend most of my day is being a consumer, being someone who lives in a country on the planet, and with all of its politics and all of its ups and downs and good news and bad news and trash media and blah, blah, blah. And so to shift from that rather pinched down version of humanness to something globally expansive, that's something that I need a tribe to do. And I'm just very, very pleased that we have this venue, this podcast with Carolyn, Peter, listeners, to call ourselves, at least for a moment, a tribe, a group of caring individuals sharing and putting their hearts into creating together and doing our best in the face of that daunting climate change and other challenges. So I thank you for having me on, and very much look forward to the Senate candidate from California.
Dean, would you stay on the line with us? I'm not sure if we have Mike on the line yet or not, but let's or do we have Mike? I don't think so. Okay, so while we're getting Mike on the line, we can begin to set up this conversation that we'll have with him, in that, you know, I stumbled onto him through an article in Grist the other day, that there's this guy running for Senate in California where I live, and he's basing his campaign on the fact that climate change is really the number one and only thing we should be talking about.
Yeah.
And wow, what a delightful surprise that was.
Yeah. Well, this is a person with extraordinary level of courage, and there's a portion in the writing I'm doing for this book coming up that I'm really up for redefining a couple things. I want to redefine hope, and that's a whole other story for another day, but I also want to redefine heroism or heroes and who they really are now, because I'm afraid that the military version or the battlefield version is no longer the most important from my point of view. I think the real heroes of our time are the people like this candidate that you're describing, who's willing to just take on the third rail of all third rail options and make it the center of his platform. This is someone with huge courage. And as far as I'm concerned, whether he wins or not, it doesn't matter. he's blazing new trails, and that takes courage, and I consider him a hero.
Yeah, thank you. I do too. I had the luxury to talk to him a little bit the other day, and was just amazed at, wow, where do you come up with the cojones to step into something like this? And I think is there a new person that's been added? Mike, are you on?
He is being added at the moment. We have to hook him up. So that's happening at the moment.
Okay, great. I'll continue.
They will let me know, I believe, when he is on. I'll keep checking.
Okay, and Peter, it looks like if you have a screen in front of you to follow the conversation, it looks like if you have.
Do we have a Skype name for him?
If you have Mike, then.
Yes, in fact, I sent that to you, Carolyn, but I'll say it just out loud. It's Smithers, Smithers. And he had sent me a note saying he was trying to chime in.
Can you spell that again? Smithers?
S-H-M.
F-H.
S, Sam.
Okay, S-H?
M-I.
Uh-huh.
T-H-E-R-S.
Okay, and that's it?
Yep. There's some more sound. Mike, is that you?
Okay.
Enjoying our technical difficulties, and here's our chance to just slow down, listeners.
Yeah.
And us. Did you catch yourself getting flustered that here we are wasting a whole minute? Here we are having some technical difficulty.
Yeah.
We're waiting to. He has to accept the request. So, do you have any way to communicate with him about that?
I do. I'm texting on with him now.
Okay.
You know, right, while you guys are doing that, if I may, I'd just like to speak a little bit about California.
Please do. I would love to hear you speak about California.
Yeah, I'm a longtime California resident, and I now live in Southern Oregon. And I have a deep appreciation for California for years and years now, trying their best with all the same challenges that other states have. They've, you know, tried to put in regulation that treats people or toxic chemicals or whatever their particular issues are that they're dealing with. They've been on the forefront of creating an environment that's want to care for people and the environment a bit more than some other states that I'm aware of. And I just know that they are crippled right now by the shortage of water. Just an immense challenge. And so I think what this Senate candidate is undoubtedly going to have to grapple with, perhaps before anything else, is how to create a livable, workable arrangement with water that will accommodate both the commercial sector, especially agribusiness, and of course the residents of California. And I was just aware of last week a small community near Tracy, California, has just had its water rights completely shut down.
Wow.
And so that could well be the first major domino to fall in terms of that relationship of a community, a residential community, facing off with the other demands for water in that area, which is primarily agriculture. And this is no small deal. This is, I believe it's still the eighth largest economy in the world.
Yes, it is.
And if California stumbles or full-blown collapses, the dominoes that I know you've been talking about for years, and of course Michael Rupert before on the Lifeboat Hour articulated, so what is this collapse going to look like and so on, it's hard to imagine that the country and possibly even the world would be able to handle the repercussions of that level of economy and that.
Hello?
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 This is Dean here. Can you hear me?
Hello? Peter and Dean are here.
Hello?
Hello.
Is that Mike?
This is Mike?
Yes, this is him.
Hi, Mike.
All right.
Welcome
How you
to
doing?
The Lifeboat Hour, and thank you so much for being with us and for what you're doing in the world. Tell us about your campaign.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you guys. I am running for U.S. Senate out of California on a single-issue climate change platform.
Yeah, and you also dare to just come right out and say that we're all going to die. What's up with that?
Well, you got to get the conversation started. You know, it's a
right.
There's inadequate attention being paid to the issue, which is what motivated the whole campaign. And you know, when it comes down to it, but the attention is important as much as it's difficult to say such things. It's important to grab attention. You know.
Well, I really want to know why you've made this a single issue. And I mean, maybe that should be obvious to all of us, but tell us from your own words, from your own heart, why did you make this your only issue?
I think, like many people, have a certain amount of unresolved anxiety about the climate crisis and complete inaction on part, or you know, at least relative complete inaction on the part of the federal government. And I was simply not seeing any political reaction that I thought was adequate or even close to adequate. So I decided, well, if someone a voice needs to be a voice in this room, I'm more than happy to clear my throat and speak up, even if that means, there's a lot of humor on the website in the way I present my candidacy. And by
the way, Mike, what is that website?
It is at iwillnotdonothing.org. It is also my political philosophy.
Yeah.
But that's the general approach, is that what else can you take it as absurd, the level of inaction on climate change from from the federal government? So I am hoping to provide the equal and opposite voice to that absurdity by coming down. I think I've seen my campaign referenced online as a green police state, which
nice.
Kind of the tone I'm going for, albeit not the necessarily the the mindset I keep, you know.
Right. Well, Mike, I had a great chance to talk to you yesterday, and what really moved me, and what I want to backtrack just a little, I know, well, Father's Day weekend, and I know you're a dad a couple times over now with a newborn, and tell us how that ties into your passion.
Yeah, I've got two kids. I have a 2.5-year-old son and a 3-month-old baby girl, and I was talking to Peter about this, but, you know, I'm just a newspaper reader. I'm not a scientist. I'm not an engineer. I'm not I'm not real on top of this, but I mean, you can put together the puzzle pieces from what you read in the paper every day that what needs to be getting done is not getting done. And I had reached a point in my own processing of what was happening where I felt, let me just try and do something. let me see what's in my skill set here. And because it's difficult to look at your own children and know that you're not doing everything that you can to make sure that they have had as much opportunity for a full life as you may have, you know. So my kids are no doubt a motivation. I would like to help them. I think as most parents like to help their kids, you know.
And so, Mike, where do you live in California, and how is the drought affecting you and your area?
I'm in San Francisco. I'm a born and raised San Franciscan, which I recognize a political strike against me in a lot of circles.
plus, you're a lawyer. There's two strikes.
Uh-oh, yeah.
not a whole lot lining up for my campaign. Let's just come out and say this. except for the baseline premise, which I think is pretty strong. San Francisco has been, relatively unaffected as far as, you know, everybody is doing their best to conserve. But I haven't, you know, I haven't had, you know, some of the things that they're seeing in the Central Valley of people just having their water, you know, flat out run out. But it's, you know, I'm just having lived in the same place for my entire life. I am aware of, you know, the simple change in weather patterns that's been over the last 5 years. And it's hard just to not, well, of course that plays a role. I mean, California is being, particularly, I mean, not particularly, everybody's ultimately going to be pretty equally impacted by climate change, but we are front runners in the climate change impact. So I think that we have a role in that debate to step up as, vociferously as possible and, you know, advocate for a little sanity.
Yeah, you don't have to go too far out of San Francisco to see the impact.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so your whole campaign is based on we've got to do something, or the delightful reverse, I will not do nothing. And so just today, here comes a world leader stepping onto the stage about climate change. What do you think about this Pope guy?
That's great. I mean, that's, you know, it's, what can you say? I mean, it's lovely that it happened. It's unfortunate, perhaps, that it took so long, but better late than never, I suppose. And I really hope, you know, my hope is that this clears up some of the traffic or some of the morality that overhangs. I mean, sorry, now don't misinterpret what I'm saying. I think there is a lot of positive morality to be had in the struggle against climate, but I think that there's a lot of morality that has been hung on a debate that could be taken strictly as a scientific debate. You know, we're presented with certain facts, and I think I was talking to Peter about this yesterday, but I feel like, to use a basketball analogy, the science community has floated a nice alley-oop for us for, you know, a couple of years now, and politicians for some reason are refusing to grab the ball and slam it down. You know, I feel like it can be argued that the number one purpose of government is to make sure that, you know, we all chip in and make sure we don't die. And I think that we're losing. We have somehow lost track of job number one here.
Yeah, boy, that's what the Pope had to say, and that's what I love about your refreshing approach to politics here is, A number one on the list here, keep a livable planet for humans and as many other species as possible.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a, not, this is not a, you know, rocket science.
Mike, I wanted to ask you if you're familiar with the book that I co-authored with Guy McPherson, Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind.
I am familiar with it. I have not read it, but I am aware of it and the concept, and I am aware of the work you guys are doing, yes.
So we're coming out with a second edition. We had some problems with the first one. We're coming out with a second edition this summer. We'll make sure that you get a copy because it's a wonderful marriage of really, really, really hard science, hard to read, hard to look at science, and the emotional and spiritual response to this crisis. So we want you to have it for sure.
Yeah, that sounds like a valuable read. Yeah, I mean, like I've, you know, like I said, there's a lot of tongue-in-cheek humor on my website, but I think, you know, it's hard to stare something as terrifying as, you know, climate catastrophe or, you know, climate change, whatever you want to call it, in the face without a little bit of, you know, a little bit of a laugh. You know,
it's unbearable, actually, yeah. And I'm glad that you're adding the laughs because we need that comic relief in between freaking out.
Yeah. and we need that in politics, I think, with where we're at.
It's yes.
Like, you know, it's like, okay, here I am. Yes, okay, I'll sign up. I'll raise my hand. I'm the village idiot saying that the sky is falling, basically. But what are all these other leaders doing? What they're up to? The inaction is more idiotic than my idiot energy.
that's kind of the whole vibe is. Even I, who will, you know, happily and readily and enthusiastically admit that I am underqualified for the office of U.S. Senate, I trust my own approach to this problem than what I'm seeing out of, you know, other people who are seeking the same office, you know.
Yeah, I could just imagine the debates with someone as bold as you being able to, if you can sit in the same room sometime with people or dare to put out a video question to your competitors. Please tell me what your stance is on the A number one priority for our species.
Yeah. Right.
It's not a camera-friendly question, I suppose.
I heard you talking this morning or sometime recently on MSNBC, and they asked you if you're getting any support, any contributions at all. And so can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I can. How do I say this? I launched this campaign, from a very raw personal space. I mean, that's... I launched it with an idea in mind, which is to change the conversation. I can honestly say I don't think I anticipated the response that I have gotten thus far.
In terms of positive response?
In terms of positive response, yeah. I've been overwhelmed with kind of the amount of people who have reached out and said that they support the platform and they would vote for me and they would and that's a In a certain sense, it was launched satirically. I mean, obviously with a very, core truth that was very essential. But, at this point, I'm kind of putting ducks in a row about the support that I've gotten at this point. There's no way that I'm going to, on this platform, that I'll ever raise the amount of money that a Kamala Harris or even a Loretta Sanchez or a Rocky Alvarez, the other candidates for U.S. Senate out of California are going to raise. But I think getting on the ballot is a very realistic possibility, and I think that could be huge for the conversation. So at this point, you only have to raise, I think, $3,460 to get on the ballot, which is a lot of money. You're talking millions of dollars is what these other campaigns are going to be out there. I am currently just, if people want to contribute to the campaign, just send me an email and let me know that you're interested. I'm at a position where I don't necessarily want to start taking people's money until it's clear that it's going to go to the full extent of what they would like it to go to.
And people can send you that email on your website?
On my website, yeah. There's a contact me bar on the website.
If you'd say that name one more time.
As iwillnotdonothing.org.
Okay. Well, we're coming down to the end of the show, and Mike, I really want to thank you for being with us. I really wish you well in your campaign. I certainly hope you get on the ballot. Thank you for your courage.
It's the time is there. You know what I mean? It's hard not to. When you gotta look your kids in the eyes, it's not hard to not have courage,
That's right. Well, thank you so much for being with us, and thank you, Peter Melton, Dean Walker. I am delighted to have all of you in this conversation today. Next week, folks, Mike Farragon is going to be on our show. Many of you know him from Extinction Radio and the Near Term Extinction Facebook page. So join us, because you're going to love his wonderful Scottish accent and the way he answers our questions and responds to us. And I thank you so much for being on the Lifeboat Hour today. Happy Father's Day to all of you fathers out there. We'll see you again next week.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost.